Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, Monday through Friday, on Breadbox Media to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. We are finally here in Seattle, really enjoying actual summer days, like where the temperature gets above 60. And in fact, it's up to, it's going to be in the 80s today. It's going to get even hotter later. And so we're all happy about that. And probably we'll wind up swimming in the lake at some point, although my wife is having her prayer group over today, this evening.
The 80s will be a trial for you guys, won't they?
Oh, yeah. It's you know, my wife is already, she melts like a pat of butter when it gets above like 72 degrees. So yeah. One of my favorite, Alistair Cook tells a story about... He did a series called America, which is kind of his personal history of the United States, his adoptive country. He had come here in the 30s and started doing a letter from America back to the BBC every week. And he did that forever. And then about 1970, he filmed this big, huge, multi-part documentary of the history of the United States,
I remember it. Yeah.
Well, it's one of the finest, I think, video histories of the U.S. ever made. And of course made by an Englishman. And, anyway, when he gets his favorite sort of adoptive city, was San Francisco. He loved San Francisco. And so he talks about kind of the weird, un-California-like weather that dominates San Francisco just because of the weather patterns. And so it's always socked in with fog and is cooler than the rest of the state and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very sort of Seattle-like place, except it's 1,000 miles from Seattle. And anyway, he talks about his favorite English newspaper newspaper headline of all time. Came from the Manchester Guardian, and it said 72 degrees again tomorrow, no end in sight.
Yeah. When I first was sent to Scotland in the Navy, I was a young man, I was in the Navy and stationed at a submarine base in Scotland. And I got there in what the middle was a tragic heat wave where they were having like 82 every day. Oh. And they were literally posting news reports about, it's not funny, really, people dying.
Are you serious?
Dying in a house with where the temperature outside is 82 degrees. Elderly people expired during the heat wave.
Oh, well, that's not funny.
But, no, it's not, but that was quite a shock for me, who grew up in Georgia.
Raised in Georgia.
82 is perfection. You know?
Yeah, well, you start to understand why a place like Jamestown would like have a massive death toll.
Yeah,
when they first founded the place, you know, because all these Englishmen showing up in this, you know, malaria infested.
It sounds crazy, but people were falling out in Scotland at 82 degrees.
It's amazing. Well, so we're going to be hitting the 80s, and it looks like we'll be getting up to the 90s tomorrow, and that makes me happy. And so I now start picking out my bathing suit wardrobe and thinking about the lake a lot. I'm a lake swimmer. Swimming pools are okay if they have a diving board. Otherwise, swimming pools are just big cement holes with water in them.
Where water's been allowed to collect.
Yeah. With a lake, there's something interesting that you can do. You know, you can go swim up. There's a couple of logs that we'll swim up, and we'll play King of the Log on them, and that's fun. And I was sitting on one of them one day talking to a friend of mine, and we hear this crack, clack sound, and we look over, and the next log over that's about 30 feet away, there's a bald eagle sitting on the log, like smashing this fish and eating the fish, having his lunch. And you just don't get to see that at a swimming pool very often.
No, you don't. That's awesome. So happily, we live situated between all kinds of mountain streams and the mountain lake that the streams wind up in, so We've got the lakes all around us here. So
lovely. I love that.
A happy thing. The water's pretty cold, though.
Yeah.
A lot of people who come to visit us are a little shocked.
This lake just sits there and bakes under the sun all summer long. And so, like, the top 4 or 5 feet are warm. If you go down below that, it's still like super cold water.
Yeah.
But we just don't go down there, and everything is fine. But, you know, and there's also, Jan and I went swimming there, I don't know, a few days ago. And in addition to the mating pair of bald eagles, there is now 2 very large juvenile bald eagles that, like, hang around mom still. So we were swimming the other day, and we saw 3 bald eagles, 2 of them juveniles, sitting up in this tree spar. So we named our 2 youngest kids, not quite out of the house yet, but, you know, we'll be getting ready to leave any day, our Pete and Sean. So we named the eagles Pete and Sean.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Not quite out of the nest. So,
well, you know, most people have heard that Benjamin Franklin proposed the turkey rather than the bald eagle,
right,
as the national symbol. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that's ridiculous. And one of the more curious aspects of Mr. Franklin's thought, but he actually had some pretty good reasoning behind it. He remembered, the way a lot of people don't remember now, that the bald eagle was the symbol of Imperial Rome before it became the symbol of the United States.
Oh, okay.
And he thought that was an inauspicious beginning. That,
okay.
An eagle, after all, is a raptor. It's a predator, you know.
Right.
And, you know, Rome, certainly, it was certainly fitting for Rome.
Right.
But, he had hoped that it wouldn't be fitting for the United States, and that the turkey, a much more humble, domestic, useful animal, would be a better symbol.
Yeah,
I'm not sure the eagle, the people who picked the eagle didn't turn out to have the better symbol.
Yeah. Well, that certainly has worked out to be the case. Yeah. Mm. There's something about nation states, you know, that go through these phases of just feeling the need to, you know, everywhere should be us, Rod. We've got it figured out. If we didn't have it figured out, we wouldn't be so powerful. And therefore, others should be us as well, you know,
right,
with our help and our rule.
Yep.
And there's a kind of an odd pattern that, you know, with the rise of the nation state, one of the things that happens repeatedly with different countries is this tendency to identify that country with the kingdom of God. Or the church. And so you have, you know, France becomes, you know, the eldest daughter of the church. And then you start getting, you know, with the rise of English power, you start sort of getting these legends like Joseph of Arimathea once visited England. And somehow this is why the Grail winds up in England and is the natural favored son of God. And, you know, Russia referred to itself as the Christ of nations. And then, you know, we become, you know, as we start feeling our oats, we become, you know, the America, the light and the glory, and that whole weird, you know, desire for nation states to have themselves favored with divine honors.
Well, it's perfectly understandable human emotion.
Sure.
That when you look around and see foreigners, that their ways seem foreign and strange to you.
Isn't that weird? How foreign
seem foreign? Right. And it's so obvious that they're doing things wrong, you know,
right,
that they need somebody to step in and show them how to do it, you know?
That's right. Yeah.
And so that emotion, while it may be natural, is, it needs clarification. It needs.
Yeah. And well, it's interesting. This is one of the things that Scott Hahn talked about in the past. There were Indian tribes who referred to themselves as the human beings.
All right. You know, I live amongst the Cherokee here in the Great Smoky Mountains, and they were the people.
Right.
Everybody else was a little bit not quite human.
Right. And, you know, the Greeks did the same thing. They referred to barbarians, you know, because non-Greek languages sounded like bar, bar, bar to them. And so, you know, for a brief time in their history, also saw themselves as, you know, the natural dominators, particularly under Alexander, who was trained by Aristotle. He was technically, I guess you could call him a Greek. He's a Greek speaker. That was really what held the Greeks together, was their language. If you spoke Greek, you were a Greek, even though, you know, you might be from this or that polis. But, you know, even you know, the Greeks, what you've basically wound up with was one polis, Athens, winds up becoming the top dog polis, and then immediately, in a famous phrase, tells the other polises that it's stomping on, that the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. And that was, it didn't lead to a happy outcome for Athens.
No.
Well, we'll continue this conversation when we get back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been having an interesting conversation about the way in which nationalist pride, with the rise of the nation state, and really this is something that goes back to before the nation state. You can certainly see this, for example, in ancient Egypt, in which you know, the king wasn't merely favored by the gods. The king was a god. And you get that attempt again under the Caesars. Although, you know, you sort of get the impression that Rome under the Caesar didn't really buy the whole, you know, Caesar's a god. They would like, yeah, sure, we'll do the pinch of incense, whatever. You know, this seems to be really important, you know, to Caesar, and I don't want to get my head lopped off, so whatever. But
They were a pretty wised up people. In other words, they'd watched the politics. They'd watched the sausages being made a little too much to take the divine Caesar thing too completely literally.
Yeah,
in fact, the first emperor who ever actually claimed to be indwelt by a divinity or whatever was Trajan. So, you know, 100 years or so into the empire was when that thing first arose, but I don't know that it was ever meant very, very literally.
What it boiled down was a kind of a loyalty oath, you know. And what's interesting, of course, is that the Christians and the Jews under the Caesars, in a certain sense, not even a certain sense, in a very real sense, they took that far more seriously than the Romans did themselves.
And one of the reasons they seem so unreasonable to the Romans.
Right, exactly.
You're making a big deal over this ceremony that none of us take seriously.
Right. You know, and the Christians said, no, I will not hail Caesar as a deity. There's only one God, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And the interesting thing was that Romans cut... The Romans had a policy, Romanitas, basically, of saying, look, as long as you pay your taxes, we'll let you keep whatever ancestral traditions you have. We don't really care about all that stuff.
Right.
We just want to build roads and get your tax money, and that's it. Well, and we, you know, if we need to, we'll use your land as our, you know, for our military outposts in order to protect our ever expanding frontiers. And so because of that, the Jews, because the Jews were an ancient people and had their own ancestral traditions, Romans didn't, as a general rule, try to demand divine honors.
The Jews were unusually exclusive, and it was unusually difficult to reconcile their system with the Roman system. Usually their plan was to take all the foreign gods and say, "Hey, the more gods, the merrier."
Right.
We'll come up with a Roman name for these guys, and we'll include them in the pantheon. And you know, more gods, the better. You know,
right. So yeah, it's just kind of, you know, let's be multicultural about all this. The Christians, however, were neither fish nor fowl. They were no longer considered Jews by the Jews. And at the same time, they were just, you know, as Tertullian says, we are of yesterday. They had just popped up. I mean, you guys just showed up during the reign of Pontius Pilate. He was just, you know, that's just a couple of decades ago. You're just making this stuff up, was the way the Romans looked at it. Uh-huh. And so when the Romans demanded a pinch of incense to Caesar from the Christians and they said no, they didn't get any slack, because as far as the Romans were concerned, this is not an ancient ancestral tradition. This is just something that some crazy Jews made up yesterday.
Right.
And that's why they wind up getting, you know, roasted alive and crucified and all the other things are happening to them. But of course, the paradox of the Christian position was that they regarded themselves as preserving the ancient ancestral tradition, and the Jews who had refused to receive Messiah as the guys who were fractaling off into something new and unheard of.
Right. And there's pretty good evidence that they were right in this, not just theological evidence. It's understood and accepted. There's nothing controversial about the statement that I'm going to make, and it is that modern Judaism that comes to the world by way of the rabbinical Judaism of the Middle Ages and on backward is the only form of Judaism that survived, that rabbinical form of Judaism that descends from the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pharisees were like one of over 20 different denominations
mm-hmm.
of Jews at the time of Christ. So there's 19 branches that ceased to exist.
And Essenes and Sadducees and
many others. The one branch that seems to have succeeded in carving out a niche for itself and getting itself called Judaism is the non-messianic branch.
Right.
In other words, everybody that agreed not to do what most of the dispersed Jews and the Greecified Jews of the empire were doing, which was become Christian. Mm-hmm. most of them all said, we need to, all of us non-Christians need to unite. And that was the creation of the only branch of that ancient Judaism that still survives to this day.
And the
non-messianic.
One of the fascinating, University of Washington, at least he used to be, I think maybe he's at Baylor now, a guy named Rodney Stark.
Uh-huh.
He's a sociologist.
Yep.
And one of the things that he has looked at, he's sort of crunched the numbers, estimating the number of Jews that were dispersed throughout the Roman Empire by the time of Christ. And the numbers, it looks like globally, that is, throughout the Roman Empire, there were about 6 million Jews living all over the Roman Empire. A minority of them lived in the Holy Land. Most Jews lived in the diaspora.
Right.
And the interesting thing is that by the 5th century, that the number of people who self-identify as Jews has dropped to about 1 million. So what happened to them? Well, where did they go? Rodney Stark says they didn't go anywhere. They became Christian.
I've got a chapter that deals with this very, very extensively in apostasy that wasn't.
And okay.
It quotes Rodney Stark pretty significantly. Yeah. It's the question of where did all those Jews go? And also significantly, the question of why was the growth of Christianity so explosive in the second and third centuries? Mm-hmm. And why did Constantine have so little trouble, quote unquote, converting the Roman Empire? Mm-hmm. The reality is the empire had mainly converted itself by that time. And that
interesting.
Constantine was a bit of a straggler.
Okay.
And the people who did all the converting were the God-fearers, and the dispersed Jews, people who encountered Judaism in a very messianic form, right. Much closer to God's heart in Christian estimation, and learned most of their religion from the Septuagint rather than from the Hebrew right. scrolls and all the rest of it. So anyway, it's something of a really interesting topic and yeah. figures very prominently in the idea of how the Roman Empire became Christian.
And so part, you know, one of the things that, of course, always is bound to happen is, you know, when you've got church and you've got state, one of the things that has to happen is that state has to figure out how it's going to relate to church, especially when the church is enormously popular.
Right.
And so, you know, with the breakup of the Roman Empire, there comes, you know, a period kind of before the rise of the nation state. But when the nation state appears, and by that I mean things like Spain, France, we can't really speak of Germany because there is no united Germany until the 19th century. But there are German-speaking peoples.
The Holy Roman Empire.
The Holy Roman Empire, you get that. Right, and, right. you know, and the things, the various, you know, principalities that will eventually become Italy, but don't for a long time. But you have this period where nations are sort of coalescing, condensing out of the atmosphere and finally becoming people who recognize themselves as a people. And then, of course, the first thing you want to do, if you're ruling those nations, you want to make sure that you've got the mandate of God on your side. Because, you know, people aren't going to respect your government if God isn't on your side. So then you start coming up with all these sort of national myths and this kind of creation narratives that will explain why your country is awesome. And we keep, you know, we keep doing that. We do that here in the United States all the time, of course.
It raises the issue of how Christians should look at nationalism. And or patriotism. Is there right. a difference? Is patriotism a virtue? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not necessarily something that you find on the Catholic list of the seven cardinal virtues.
Right.
And yet many people would put it very high on the list.
Right.
Myself included, as a matter of fact.
But right.
The question is, we need to parse. We need to spend a little more time parsing out the difference between words like nationalism and exceptionalism and things like this.
with faith. Yeah. Well, let's do that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with none other than Rod Bennett. And we've been talking a little bit about patriotism and nationalism. By the way, if you want to be a patriot of Connecting the Dots, here's something that you can do. It's like super easy. Go to breadboxmedia.com. And if you like what you're getting on this show, and you want me to go on being able to feed my children, what you can do is you can become a friend of the show. The nice thing about being a friend of the show is that you get stuff. Be a friend of the show basically means you're kicking in 10 bucks a month that will go to me. And in return for that, I'm going to be giving you, you know, access to private stuff that I post, both fun and serious, as well as there's a freebie book that you can get if you're if you win my you know be the first one to kick something in this month award, and. All kinds of good things will happen. So go to breadboxmedia.com, click on Become a Friend of the Show, enter my name in the Friend of the Show data bank, and we can we will proceed from there. Just 10 bucks a month. Hey, Rod Bennett.
Yes, Mark Shea.
We were talking before the break about... the distinction between patriotism and nationalism. One, I think, is healthy Catholic civic involvement. So you can see, you know, Jesus is, among other things, Jesus is a patriot of Israel. He's somebody who loves his country. He anguishes over his country. And sometimes he issues terrible, terrible warnings to his country, like all the other prophets do. But this is not like the prophets. He doesn't despise Israel. He doesn't want Israel to lose. What he wants is for Israel to be what Israel has been called to be by God.
Mm-hmm. He looks out over the city and says, how many times? That's right.
And the prophets kill those sent to you. How often have I wanted to gather you as a hen gathers chicks under her wings, but you would not?
Yep. That's it. Well, and that distinction is very important. I think G.K. Chesterton did a lot of good work in this area. He identified patriot. The root word is fatherland. You know, patriotism. The root word there is love of your fatherland. Mm-hmm. And Chesterton parsed that out pretty well, I think. In other words, he said, love for your country is love for that.
Right.
In other words, it's love for your nation's language, its folkways, its songs, its wildlife, its scenery, all of these things. But none of that stuff has much to do with politics.
Right.
In other words, it's not a campaign or a foreign policy or a form of government even.
Right.
I mean, many of the nations of Europe have had many forms of government over their 1,000-year or 2,000-year history, and we've actually had it too, because our Constitution only starts about the halfway mark of American history. So patriotism is not necessarily to be identified with a political system or a political program. And that's a really important distinction. You can love America without talking about politics at all.
Right. And, yeah. And so Chesterton says that, jingoistic, nationalistic sentiments like my country, right or wrong. He says that's like saying my mother drunk or sober. Sure, you love your mother, but you don't, you're not indifferent to the fact that your mother is a drunk.
Right.
You don't want her to be a drunk because you love her.
Well, I think General de Gaulle had a good supplementary quote there. He said that patriotism is when the love of your own people comes first. Nationalism is when hate for people other than your own comes first.
Right.
Yeah. And that sense of our ways need to be exported to all those foreigners is where we start to get into trouble.
Yeah. And 100 years ago, the phrase fatherland would not have struck a chill into the heart, but now it does.
Well, yeah, the nationalism reached its zenith in a country which literally took it to idolatrous heights and offered human sacrifice to the idol. So, yes, the word's a little hard to
hard to
take seriously.
And so,
but it's a good old American idea. George Washington, the father of his country, and all the rest of it.
Sure. And a pre-American idea. I mean, it goes way back, you know.
Just like most people wouldn't think of naming their sons Adolf these days. We don't have too many people that feel comfortable with talking about the fatherland these days.
Right.
But but it'll come back around. So.
Well, and it's you know, it really does. It's a natural progression. You know, you love your family,
right?
And so, and this is something that has been lost and distorted in modernity. We've had a kind of a libertarian reaction to the notion. Today, for example, it was practically a truism when JFK said, "Ask not what your country can do for you; ask what you can do for your country." That was taken as just normal. Of course, you know, you owe something to your country. A lot of that has been lost in a kind of libertarianized culture, which hears that and simply says, that's socialism. That's, you know, right. State domination. It's all about the individual, and any claim by the state on a citizen, saying that a citizen owes.
Well, it's all rights and no responsibilities. All rights and no responsibilities. A very weird conception.
Yeah.
The idea that the state can owe you something, but you can't owe it anything.
Right.
And it's not like that.
This is one of the things that Pope Benedict makes clear in Caritas in Veritate, is that we owe an incalculable debt. This is also something that Laudato Si is talking about, that every one of us is, simply by virtue of the fact that we were born, practically, is we are instantly enmeshed in this huge network of relationships in which we owe debts that we can never ever repay. The fact that you and I are able to converse with each other in English is because our parents, God bless them, and our whole civilization that precedes them, gave us the English language free of charge. Here, this is just part of your birthright. And that's just one tiny bit, you know, the fact that we're able to conduct this conversation on an internet that neither of us understands, right. Could possibly have built, you know. And beyond that, I mean, just this massive network of gifts that has been handed to us by a human race that essentially, you know, fought and bled and died so that we wouldn't be having this conversation, for example, in German.
Right.
Or, you know, or whatever. And just so much that we can't possibly repay. The fact that neither of us have died of smallpox because somebody gave us a vaccine that we didn't understand at the time we were getting. But we are the recipients of a massive amount of gift. Mm-hmm. And what our tradition then tells us is pay it back by paying it forward. Love your children. Find some way to be generous, going above and beyond merely what is owed. To among other things, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about patriotism, whereas we're talking about a legitimate love of neighbor that extends to your people, not merely your neighborhood or your guy next door. And, you know, who is my neighbor then becomes the gospel question. And ultimately the answer to the gospel is anybody you meet.
Well, yeah, the church certainly teaches love for all your neighbors, however foreign, however different they look than you are. Mm-hmm. But the church, interestingly, though, the church does, in the New Testament, does make a distinction about a special kind of love that we feel for the brethren.
Right.
In other words, there's a Christian agape love that that is laid out pretty clearly in the New Testament. So the idea that let's just say that love for all humanity shouldn't become so much the prominent idea that you lose the natural love, patriotic love for your family, your immediate. In other words, the two things are compatible. They're not at war with each other. But right. It is true that that there's a natural human love that comes naturally that the church affirms.
Right. Your love absolutely.
Those
because people. That's where love is incarnated. And love has to have flesh and bones on it or it's not real. We will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. We'll be back right after this.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Rod Bennett. We're talking about the distinction between patriotism and nationalism. I think one of probably the best description I've ever heard of the distinction between patriotism and nationalism is that patriotism is to a country what healthy Christian self-love is to a person. And nationalism is to a country what pride, the sin of pride, is to a person. And I think that goes an awful long way. There's a certain curious satanic death wish at the heart of the sin of pride. Because what you're ultimately saying is, I don't need God, which is to say, I don't need life or sanity or goodness.
Right.
All I need is me and my power.
If people would leave me alone and let me do it my way, I'd wind up like Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. And so you find that those, you know, I mean, what becomes of the leaders of the greatest nationalist death cult of the 20th century. Well, suicide is what becomes of them. You know, they want their very last act is to kill even themselves rather than to admit error.
Yeah, and one of the last things Hitler did was to order Albert Speer, who was his interior minister, to go out and bomb every bridge, every dam, every power plant in Germany, to bomb his own country back to the Stone Age.
Right.
And the reason for this was that the Germans had proved themselves unworthy of the great destiny that they'd been called to. Now, this is such a complete reversal, the negative mirror image of everything Hitler had said for his entire life up to this point.
Right.
That
of course, because he was a liar, right?
Right. He turned on the great German people, something which is impossible. Right. I mean, he sort of, it's like antimatter and matter coming together. For Hitler to say the Germans are unworthy is suicide in every way possible.
Right.
Thankfully, Speer, thankfully, remembered that he had some duties to humanity left, so he refused to carry out the orders at some personal cost.
Right. So. Yeah, and that's the thing about the sin of pride, is that at the end of the day, the sin of pride, it looks, because the devil is the ape of God, the sin of pride looks like self-love, but it's not. There is a real, we're commanded by God to love your neighbor as you love yourself. And so there is a real place for a real healthy Christian self-love. That love will involve self-denial, because what you're doing in any real act of love is you're giving yourself away to God. So there's a kind of self-abnegation that happens, but that's so that you can receive from right. God the love well, that he is.
Christ makes it very clear when his apostles come to him asking for the chief seats in the new kingdom.
Right.
And he says, you don't understand what this kingdom's all about if you're still thinking in those terms. The
right.
The one who's greatest among you will be the servant of all. And, of course, he washes their feet to illustrate this idea. And right. So the idea that our nation is the greatest nation, therefore it should lord it over the Gentiles, is, explicitly wrong.
Right.
From a Christian point of view.
Right, and that's, you know, that's what's modeled for us then in the gospel is a God who literally gives himself away to be eaten. That's what Jesus does for us. He makes himself our food. The reading in the prophets today at Mass, the whole thing from the book of Ezekiel is a complaint from God against the shepherds of Israel. And why are the shepherds of Israel wrong? Why does God declare that he's going to come against them? He declares that he's going to come against them because they are making the flock their food.
Right.
They are eating the flock. And of course, this is what Hitler did. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of a an example of this in chemical purity, of course. But you know, we can see this with any country that in which power stops being a tool in order to give life to other people, and starts becoming an end in itself. And this is a great, you know, this is a great warning that we see in things like The Lord of the Rings. The ring becomes this image of power, that all it does is it seeks to suck in everything else into it, you know.
Right.
And this is the great danger of nationalism. When pride in your country becomes an end in itself, and everything else must bow before it, it ceases to be love. As patriotism, properly understood, is a form of love, nationalism is a form of consuming pride.
Yeah.
So.
And well, something for Christians to be on their guard for.
Right.
It's a besetting sin in many mm-hmm. places, but mm-hmm. the appeal to make God into, make your country, the symbols of your country into an idol is still very strong and still right. with us.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, you wind up with that kind of distorted pride, just as, self-love, pride looks like self-love. So nationalism often looks like patriotism, and it uses all the rhetoric of patriotism. If you don't agree with the state on whatever horrible thing that it's, you know, makes its policy, then you hate your country. You're an enemy of the state. And you know, that has been, you know, one of the great tragedies of the 20th century is watching nation states do that. You know, the Soviet Union did it, and Nazi Germany did it, and we've done it. Communist China has done it. It's a constant temptation. And Caesar is not at all afraid to use the trappings of religion to get that message across. You know, you're not merely an enemy of the state, you're also an enemy of God. And we see all that, you know, at play, for example, in the crucifixion. The charges against Jesus are in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. The Latin, you know, indicates that Jesus is a criminal in the eyes of Caesar. The Hebrew intimates that he is a criminal in the eyes of God, that God has condemned him as well. And that's always a danger that we have to face, that we will start to mix up, you know, what Caesar says with what God says. Always a huge peril that we face.
Though there are some limits to the quote that I'm about to give you, it's still a good quote. Mark Twain said that patriotism means to love your country, your country all the time, and your government when it deserves it. And that's pretty good. Like I say, there's lots to talk about in there, but love your country all the time and your government when it deserves it.
Well, and this is, you know, this is something that Chesterton talks about as well when he talks about, you know, why do you love your country? He says, if you love your country for a reason, then when the reason goes away, you're not going to love your country anymore. Yeah. And this could apply for any kind of unconditional love. But he says, you know, what's necessary is to love without any reason.
Like you do your family.
Yeah, because you love your family because they're yours. Yeah. If you love something for a reason, when that reason vanishes, then there's no reason left to love your country. But if you love something for no reason, simply because it's yours, which is the way God loves us.
Yeah.
I mean, what have we done to deserve God's love? You know?
Right. It's also very important mentally to prepare yourself to like the fact that foreigners love their country just like you love yours. In other words, they have the same feelings, and they're quite right to have the same feelings about their own nation, the scenery, the music, all the rest of it we talked about. If you can do that, if you can keep that in mind, that patriotism is all equally valid and always valid.
Yeah.
It's nationalism that needs to be doled out when you deserve it. You know? In other words, you need to apply the patriotism unconditionally, but the support for the system, the government and everything, conditionally.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. And that really is the case. You know, I mean, this is what undergirds the American founding, and it's what undergirds the three branches of government, is the state is, well, I won't call it a necessary evil because Paul says that it's instituted by God, but it is, you know, very clearly the state is not something that is divinely inspired. Right. It's, you know, it's there to restrain evil. We'll have to talk about that some other time, but thank you. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back tomorrow. Until then, I want to thank Rod Bennett for being on the show. Ethan Bolin has been our producer. Thank you so much.